This is CD 3 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains session number 3 titled Karma and Reincarnation.
Last time we made very immediate the conflict that Arjuna was facing. And to review that, let me just quote from Matthew, "If anyone wishes to come after me, says Christ, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For he who would save his life will lose it, but he who loses his life for my sake will find it. For what does it profit a man if he gain the whole world, but suffer the loss of his own soul? For he who would save his life will lose it, but he who loses his life for my sake will find it." That isn't any too melodramatic a statement of the predicament we find ourselves in, that the entire life we have known turns out to be something that must be given up. Statement is made over and over again in the spiritual literature. If you give it up, give it all up, you get it all. Might be paraphrased differently. If you give it all up, you be it all. But you can't have a secret stash. It's all got to go. Now, people say to me, is therapy useful? And my answer always is, if you have Buddha as your therapist, you have a good chance of getting liberated. But if you have a therapist who thinks they're a therapist, watch out. And here is Arjuna, who has reflected a great neurotic predicament of total emotional breakdown, and he gets so dramatic that Sanjaya reports him saying, at the beginning of the second chapter, when Arjuna, the great warrior, had thus unburdened his heart, he said, "I will not fight, Krishna." And then he fell silent. Now, it turns out that Arjuna does have a good therapist, and we're now going to examine the strategies that Krishna uses in dealing with us at this moment of conflict. Because now comes the answer, which is the answer at one level of an external teacher, at another level it's the answer of God, at another level it's the answer of our self, capital S, to our self, little s. Can be an inner dialogue. And the first major argument that Krishna puts forth is one that we have to come directly to terms with, because he lays this right out within the first couple of pages. He says, because we have been, this is 2:12, because we have all been for all time, I, thou, and those kings and men, guys on the other side, and we shall be for all time, we all forever and ever. As the spirit of our mortal body wanders on in childhood and youth and old age, the spirit wanders on to a new body. Of this, the sage has no doubts. Now, we can reflect on reincarnation as a primarily intellectual concept. But it seems to me that my responsibility as one of us who is also on the pathless path, is to share with you the guts way in which reincarnation resonates within me. There are, and this last line, of this the sage has no doubts. There are three ways in which one gets to know this kind of inner wisdom, talking now about higher wisdom, buddhi knowledge, the knowledge of the higher intellect, this other kind of wisdom as opposed to knowledge. That is, you can develop this wisdom through direct experience, like you personally have experienced previous incarnations. The second way is you can develop it through your relationship with another being. That is, specifically for me, my relationship to my guru is such that there is no place in me that doubts him. No place left. So it's the same kind of trust that develops between a mother and a child. When the child is very, very young, there is a total openness to the mother and to the mother's protectiveness. Only later does the ego develop and that separateness. And before that separateness, there is a kind of openness to another being. And we'll talk more about that later, about the relation to the guru. And when that openness occurs, you trust what comes from the other being. You don't sit around and say, well, I wonder if he's right or not. Living in India with my guru and with other beings of such purity that the question of, are they telling me, A, the truth, or B, are they distorting the reports of their experiences, become irrelevant to me. And I just open to it and say, yeah, right. So the second way is through someone who knows, and you know they know, and they tell you how it is. And the third way is through your intellect, and that is through an extension and extrapolation from your rational, logical, analytic processes. That is, you study something and you say, well, from this, this, and this, this makes sense, and this comes together as the way it ought to be. Now, in the course of recorded history, a number of beings who, for me, like my guru, are beings whom I don't doubt, tell me about reincarnation. They tell me how it is. And I would say that from my point of view, that is the basic way in which I understand reincarnation to exist. I've had lots and lots of far-out experiences, mainly through psychedelics, where I have flipped in and out of images of myself in other realms, but I don't know that to be reincarnation. I could argue that it is if I wanted to grab at something, but that would be grabbing. Let me just read you a couple of quotes from beings who, like my guru, are people whom I trust. Rumi, the Persian mystic. I died as stone and rose again as plant. I died as plant and became an animal. I died as animal and was born a man. Why should I fear? When was I less by dying? Yet once more shall I die as man to soar with the angels. But even from angelhood I must pass on. For all is change except the face of God. Now towards the angel world I wing my way upwards into boundless light. Oh, let my ego cease, for non-existence sings as the song of the harp. To him we return. Now, for those of you that are having difficulty bringing together Buddhism and Hinduism and dualism and non-dualism and theism and non-theism and all of the stuff, you're going to have fun with little lines like those last three lines. Here is a total bhakti dualistic trip, right? Except for the last three lines. Oh, let my ego cease, for non-existence sings. Non-existence sings as the song of the harp, and then to him we return. Him being non-existence. Okay. So just play. Don't get too heavy about it. It's all right. Hazrat Inayat Khan. There is no such thing as death. There is no such thing as an end. Everything, every being, every particle has a continuity because life is continual. End or death is only change. Therefore, every thought that has once crossed the mind, every feeling that has once passed through the heart, every word that is once spoken and perhaps never thought about any longer, every action once done and forgotten is given a life, and it continues to live. Muhammad. Each person is only a mask which the soul puts on for a season. It wears its proper time, then is cast off, and another is worn in its stead. When Crito asked, "In what way shall we bury you, Socrates?" Socrates answered, "In any way you like. But first you must catch me." Be of good cheer, my dear Crito, and say that you are bearing my body only, and do with that whatever is usual and what you think best. This is a quote from Jack London, who was hung. I, like any man, am a growth. I did not begin when I was born, nor when I was conceived. Through incalculable myriads of millenniums, all these experiences of all these lives have gone to the making of the soul stuff or the spirit stuff that is I. I am this spirit compounded of the memories of my endless incarnations. I am all of my past. All my previous selves have their voices, echoes, promptings in me. My every mode of action, heart of passion, flicker of thought is shaded, toned infinitesimally by that vast array of other selves that preceded me and went into the making of me. I am man born of woman. My days are few, but the stuff of me is indestructible. I have been woman born of woman. I have been a woman and born my children, and I shall be born again. Oh, incalculable times again shall I be born. And yet the stupid dolts about me think that by stretching my neck with a rope, they will make me cease. Now, in our Western religious traditions, we notice slipping into the Bible questions where the disciples asked Christ, was this man born blind because of something he did previously or because of his parents or what? In other words, that whole question is based on an assumption of reincarnation. And Christ said that John the Baptist was Elijah previously. In Solomon's Book of Wisdom, it says, to be born in sound body with sound limbs is a reward of the virtues of past lives. What happened in Christianity about reincarnation was that in the councils of Nicaea, Trent, and Constantinople, which were in the first 500-600 years AD, reincarnation was not a functional philosophy to keep the church's control, because if it was merely a continuing dance, you didn't really get so worried about good and evil in this life that heavily. And so it was ruled out as a basic tenet of the church. But in the time of Christ, reincarnation was very much part of the scene. Only recently now are Western psychologists starting to become interested in reincarnation. There is a very interesting book by Ian Stephenson on 20 cases of reincarnation. It's now becoming a serious study. I was a psychologist in one recent incarnation, and I was always faced with, I was a student of personality research, and we tried to figure out, I would study parents and children and try to predict why children were the way they were in view of how the parents had been, and in view of their environment and all the heredity and environment as we in psychology measured it. And we had high-powered computers, and we would measure everything that was measurable in the parents and everything that was measurable in the environment that we, as in our sophisticated theoretical way, would understand to be determinants of how you come out being who you are. And we would feed it all into a calculator, computer, and out would come a prediction of who you were, right? And then we would measure who you are, and we would see how close our prediction was to who, in fact, you came out to be. You understand the strategy? And it was building a body of scientific knowledge about cause and effect, assuming that you were the product totally of this life, environment, and heredity. The best correlations we ever got in that kind of research, and we were average for the course, was roughly about 0.5. And a 50.5 correlation means that you are explaining about 25% of the variability. That means if I pick you and try to predict who you are because I know everything about you in this lifetime, about 25% of your whole picture I could possibly predict. The other 75% just comes out strange. Which I then, as a social scientist, say, well, that's due to error of measurement, or it's due to the fact that we just aren't complex enough in our system. It never enters my mind as a psychologist that my theory might be wrong, because you get very wedded to your theories. and especially when you've come out of a behavioral tradition of philosophical materialism. But that 75% of the variability leaves ample space for reincarnation theory, may I say. So it is not possible yet to pit Western science against reincarnation in any very powerful way. In terms of anecdotes with people like Mozart, who create sonatas at 4, give public recitals at 5, composes his first opera at 7, or a little girl in India who at 7 years old tells her father, "Look, I was living in another village and I've got 2 children and I must go visit them right away," and grabs her father and persuades him to take them there and tells the father all about how the village was changed in the last 40 years, which in fact was just how it was changed, and finds her 3 children and then is taken back crying, saying, "You can't take me from my children." And from your own experience, the number of times you meet someone where you feel, "Haven't we been through this before? Don't I know you from somewhere?" Now, a Western scientist says, well, all that is similarity of cues. Rodney Collin, in his book Theory of Celestial Influences, talks about reincarnation, but he says, it isn't like the Bridie Murphy thing where you're born and then you die and then you're born again a few years later and then you die and you're born again. He said, it's really like a fifth dimension. We've all been right here thousands of times. Don't you remember? I mean, I've said 1,000 times to you. 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 And he says the experience that most of us have had of deja vu, of, oh, wow, I must be going insane. I know I've been right here before, and you'd said the same thing to me. He said, that isn't crazy. It's just that the circuitry burns through when you get a little flash of the last time around we did this. And it goes around and around and around. And each time you're a bit more conscious until finally you get to the level of yogic awareness where you remember. And then once that starts, the whole game starts to change. Then that's the beginning of the end. And if you would like some measure of the time span we're talking about, there is in the Southern Buddhist literature a beautiful image of this. Buddha was talking about the length of time we've been doing this game of reincarnating. See, Buddha went inside because he had the power of being able to get himself free of his own thoughts, which you will if you keep meditating. And he looked and he saw his last 99,000 incarnations, one by one. And he said, if you took a rock 1 mile wide, 1 mile deep, and 1 mile high, and every 100 years a man came by with a silk shawl and ran the shawl over the rock. Got that image? It's a mile by a mile by, it's practically all of Boulder, a rock. A boulder that high. Right. And this man comes by with a silk shawl every 100 years once, runs it over the rock. In the length of time it would take for that silk shawl to wear out that rock, that would be one age period. And we have been doing this for innumerable ages. In the Hindu, the Kalpa in the Hindu calendar is considered something like 4,300,000 years. And we've been going on for Kalpas. Kalpas. Now, what is it that goes on and what is it that changes? And why is Krishna using this immediately as a powerful argument, saying, Arjuna, don't get freaked about what you're about to do. It's all in the cards. This is all part of a continuing process of which you're part. For beyond time, he dwells in these bodies, though these bodies have an end in their time. But he remains immeasurable, immortal. Therefore, great warrior, carry on thy fight. And this is the really very powerful line. If any man thinks he slays, or if another thinks he is slain, neither knows the way of truth. The eternal in man cannot kill. The eternal in man cannot die. He is never born. He never dies. He is in eternity. He is forevermore. Never born and eternal. He does not die when the body dies. As a man leaves an old garment and puts on one that is new, the spirit leaves his mortal body and wanders on to one that is new. One of the most vivid traditions in which reincarnation is dealt with and brings it very much home to us here is that of the Tibetan tradition. Lama Govinda, Anagarika Govinda, has written, "It may be argued that nobody can talk about death with authority who has not died, and since nobody apparently has ever returned from death, how can anybody know what death is? The Tibetan will answer, there is not one person, indeed not one living being, that has not returned from death. In fact, we have all died many deaths before we came into this incarnation, and what we call birth is merely the reverse side of death, like one of the two sides of a coin, or like a door which we call entrance from outside and exit from inside. It's much more astonishing that not everybody remembers his or her previous death. And because of this lack of remembering, most persons do not believe there was a previous death. But likewise, most people don't remember their birth, and yet they don't doubt that they were recently born. They forget that active memory is only a small part of our normal consciousness, and that our subconscious memory registers and preserves every past impression and experience which our waking mind fails to recall. There are those who, in virtue of concentration and other yogic practices, are able to bring the subconscious into the realm of discriminative consciousness and thereby to draw upon the unrestricted treasury of subconscious memory, wherein are stored the records not only of our past lives, but the records of the past of the race, the past of humanity, and of all pre-human forms of life, if not of the very consciousness that makes life possible in this universe. But if through some trick of nature the gates of an individual subconscious were suddenly to spring open, the unprepared mind would be overwhelmed and crushed. Therefore, the gates of the subconscious are guarded by all initiates and hidden behind the veil of mysteries and symbols." And it was this that Jung kept wrestling with his collective unconscious, which was a very close way in which a Westerner was getting to the idea of reincarnation. And in our own midst is the interesting phenomenon of Trungpa Rinpoche, who is a tulku. And for those of you that are not familiar with that concept, in the Tibetan tradition, when a very high lama or a high incarnation dies, a group of oracles sit in meditation until they share a vision of where the new reincarnation has been born. And then they send out a search party and they say, go to a house with a blue roof by a lake 2 miles north of this village, and you will find a baby who is at this point 7 months old, and that will be it. And they go and they knock at the door and they say, do you have a son 7 months old? And the family says yes, and they say, well, this is really so-and-so. And the mother says, oh, wow, I thought all the time was my baby. But I'm so honored that my baby turned out to be the incarnation of so-and-so. And then they take the baby and they robe it and take it back and put it in the throne. And they give it a number of tests. They test it with its old dorje and a new dorje and its old bell and a new bell. And if the tests are suitably passed, then they start to train this being. And for the next 19 years in Trungpa's case, or something like that, there was very intensive training in a way to remind him. Now, some tulkus remember and some don't. But that doesn't matter, because the oracles know. And then that being is seen as the carrying on of the tradition. Now, it's an interesting question about why the reincarnation should have been born in Tibet. And there is a line in the Gita which is in chapter 6, there are the following shlokas. Neither in this world nor in the world to come does ever this man pass away. He dwells for innumerable years in the heaven of those who did good. And then this man who failed in yoga is born again in the house of the good and the great. He may even be born into a family of yogis, where the wisdom of yoga shines. But to be born into such a family is a rare event in this world. Now, if you can begin to reflect on your own life, as I do, as a continuing part of an unfolding drama, and that which family you took birth in, who your father turns out to be, who your mother turns out to be, who your brothers and sisters turn out to be, what experiences you have had thus far in your life, are all part of a predetermined karmic package. And that all this is running off perfectly lawfully. There is no chance in this system. The laws of reincarnation, the laws of karma, are unbending. And there is no force in the universe that is aside from them. You say, well, isn't God aside from the laws of karma? Well, God, in a way, is the laws of karma. And there is a question of why someone would break their own law, though they have the capacity to destroy the whole thing with a thought, why he or she or it would do it. Now, all this that is talking about reincarnation sounds awfully solid, like you are somebody who is passing through birth and death and birth and death and birth and death. And who is that somebody? Who is that somebody? And to bring it together for you a little bit with other systems, let me quote again from the Pali literature. There are no real ego entities hastening through the ocean of rebirth, but merely life waves, which according to their nature and activities, manifest themselves here as men, there as animals, and elsewhere as invisible things. Every act you create, every act you do, depending on the desire connected with that act, which we're going to be talking about, creates in your mind what in Hinduism are called vasanas, or subtle thought forms, thought waves. And they remain. And when you die, they remain. Because what dies is the physical body, and there are sheaths, and these sheaths go. And what are remaining are these subtle mental tendencies, which function like a DNA code, which determine the next round, if you will. And as you meditate more deeply, you will begin to see your own mind coming into existence, existing and dying, coming into existence, existing and dying, coming into existence, existing and dying. But over that continuity, you will see incredible repetitiveness of the nature of the content of those thought forms. It's interesting, the question is, if you create karma now and then you are born again, are you the same person that's reaping the karma who sowed it? And it's much like if you take a candle and light another candle, is it the same flame? Or is there merely a transmission from one to another to another to another, and really the person who's reaping the karma, like you are reaping the karma of incredible past lifetimes. At one point in the Pali literature, the bhikkhus asked the Buddha, why did so-and-so, this very, very high being, why did he die such a horrible death? I mean, it isn't fair. He's been so pure, he's been so good, he's been such a high bhikkhu. Why should he die such a horrible death? And Buddha says, well, I'll tell you how it is. Some 500 births ago, he killed his parents. And he's been paying for it every birth since then. Now, I can experience in my own life that when I go to India and go into these villages and I find myself doing sadhana and sitting in a very simple environment and realize that I came out of a Jewish middle-class Boston environment where 12 years ago I didn't even know the word yoga. And if anybody had said, you know, 12 years from now you'll be a yogi, when I was on the Harvard faculty, I would have laughed. Nowhere in my professional career planning. But when I got to that place, it felt right on, and it felt as if I was, quote, coming home. I remember talking with Bhagwan Das, who, when he was 17, left America, Laguna Beach, and went on to India. And when he got to India, he said, I felt like I was home. It was like this was my spiritual connection. This was a place. This was reverberating with something deeper in me. Now, why me? What about all the rest of the people I grew up with in Newton Center, who are now lawyers and in the clothing business and the shoe business and so on? You know, why me? And why did it feel so right each step of the way? And when Hari Das said to me, you did a lot of yogic work in your last life, but you fell. So here you are again. Because when you finish your work, you aren't. So this isn't. So you already know that you didn't make it last time. Unless you happen to be an avatar who dropped by. Okay. And so if you can conceive of the fact that your life is this continuity, now it becomes interesting to examine your life as to what is it do you suppose that I'm supposed to be doing this round? Like, what am I doing here? How do you explain what's happening to me? Suddenly you look at your suffering and you look at all of your trips and your melodramas, and instead of seeing them as discrete acts, discrete events, bounded by birth and death, you begin to conceive of them in a much greater design, which calms you down a great deal. There's a great calmness in trying to share and understand the idea of continuity of karma or reincarnation. And what the drama is that we are sharing about what Arjuna is being trained to do is to evolve to the point where the acts that he performs are not performed in an attached fashion, which we will deal with a lot, and by not being performed in that way, they do not create any new karma. So that at that point, he is all finished performing new stuff, creating more stuff, which keeps creating more births, and at that point, all that happens is that it runs off until it's done, till the old karmas run off. It isn't true that the minute you are fully enlightened, fully aware of the whole thing, at that point, you as a desiring, thinking, seeking, remembering entity may not be around. But the dance goes on until it's finished. Until it's finished. As long as the life energies are stored up, the five skandhas keep going. Buddha got enlightened, and then for 40 years he hung around. There are different stages of that bodhisattva place. One is after the fact, and one's before. Before it, you're somebody taking a vow to do something. Afterwards, bodhisattvaism is, but you aren't. Now, if you can stay with this reincarnation concept and the idea that you are a set of karmic conditions running off, like when I was studying with my meditation teacher and I'd come in and I'd say, I'm meditating and so much anger is coming up. He'd say, it's only old karma running off, just stuff running off. And in fact, your whole life is just karma running off. Now, what Krishna is doing at this point with Arjuna is he's giving him a context to understand his act, realizing that he is part of a dance that's much more profound than the one he thought he was. When I'm with my father now, it's very interesting because at the stage I'm at in my own development, I look and I realize that it just happens that in this incarnation he's my father and I'm his son. And I feel like saying to him, hey, in there, you know, isn't it far out who we're being this time? In the autobiography of a yogi, when Yogananda meets his guru after the guru's left his body in a hotel room in Bombay, and he didn't leave his body in a hotel room in Bombay, excuse me, that was a con. He came back to visit with Yogananda in a hotel room in Bombay. And Yogananda said, well, tell me how it is on the other side of the veil, of the curtain. And Yukteswar was describing how it is when you meet all your past mothers and fathers. I mean, you've had thousands of them. We've all been each other's grandfather. I mean, it's this incredibly intertwining thing. So you had a little incestual desire for your mother one life? Well, here she is. I mean, it makes Freud's work look very naive. It is so far out, as I've gotten into it, I mean, in guts into it, that there isn't a chance that any of us could even meet momentarily on the street to blink at one another, were it not part of the fact that you are my karma and I am yours in a perfectly lawful way. Now, you've got to struggle to understand the relation of free will and determinism and to be able to deal with the paradox of both of them existing simultaneously. And the way that works is that there is a plane of reality where you think you walked in this door, you think you joined Naropa Institute, you think you decided what to eat for breakfast, you think you're going to decide to go to the party or not later today, you think you are a free agent. On that plane, you are, in fact, a free agent. There is another plane of consciousness, another flick of the television dial, another perceptual vantage point from which you begin to see that all those thought forms that say, gee, I think I'll go to the party, didn't come out of the void. Well, they did, but they came not purely, not conditionally out of the void. They were conditioned. They came out of all the previous sets of events. In this lifetime, previous experiences with parties and so on, but much more profound than that. I mean, there are stages of development, which I am not, where you are fully conscious of the laws unfolding in front. You're merely a viewer of how it all happens. For me at this point, it's a little more kind of a surprise. Like I'll be invited to give a lecture in some small university or small town somewhere, and I won't know why I accepted for that particular one, because I go and I speak to the audience, and they don't seem particularly interested in what I have to say. And I think, what the hell am I doing here? I mean, Maharaji, what do you have in mind? What kind of nonsense is this? And then I stay overnight, and I'm left alone, and I then go from the motel by taxi to the airport, and I've got a half an hour before the plane, and I go in to have a cup of coffee, and I sit down, and somebody comes over and says, may I share this table, because the tables are crowded. Certainly, sit down. And we look at each other, and there it is. In that moment is, oh, far out. That's what I'm doing in this town. It's like Maya Baba was crossing the United States by train, and he got to Santa Fe, and he got off the train and he walked into the town and he walked through the town and he walked up to a certain corner in the middle of the street and there was an old Indian standing there. And he walked up and they looked at each other a couple of seconds. Then Maya Baba turned, walked back, got on the train and left. He said, well, now my work is finished. Now that all sounds like incredible showbiz. After all, if he knows all that, he could certainly do it on another plane. That's more law that we can play with later. But if you will just start to look at your own life now in terms of reincarnation and karma, as Krishna is inviting Arjuna to do. Once on a television show with Trungpa, I said to Trungpa, what's the value of your lineage, Trungpa? And he said, well, it allows you to realize that you're merely part of a continuing of continuity of the vehicle which carries the precious jewel. And when you truly get into the time spans about the illusion of your own existence over time, to see this life as but a breath, see this life as but a flick in time, it starts to change the meaning of every act, moment by moment by moment by moment. And what Arjuna is asked to recognize by Krishna is that it's his karmic predicament that he has been born as a Kshatriya at this moment where it is his responsibility to uphold the Dharma by fighting this war. You may not have asked to come to Naropa Institute to struggle with all these conflicting values that you're facing now, but by God, you're here. By God, you're here. And this is Kurukshetra, it turns out. It looks more like a tennis match, but it's among gentlemen. But this is the battlefield. It's the battlefield within yourself, really. And though you didn't ask to do it, at one level you are getting your just deserts. You are getting the benefit of all the work you've ever done up till now to put you in the predicament where you are sharing 5 weeks with other beings who are concerned with becoming conscious in a way that 99% of the population couldn't give less of a damn about. Doesn't that seem strange, what you're doing in a situation like that? Why me? Why me? Why any of us? And as that time span develops that the Gita talks a great deal about, you come into a space about your present incarnation where the whole desperateness of getting enlightened starts to cool down a bit. And you merely understand that you are a process. I am a process. A process of continuing mind moments, each separate from each other. There is no permanent me that is being incarnated. There's merely cause and effect, and cause and effect, and cause and effect, and cause and effect. And that's all the passing parade of the laws of prakriti, the laws of nature, the laws of the unfolding of the illusion of manifestation of Maya. And you get very dispassionate in watching your own incarnation unfold. Because you see that even the melodrama of trying to get enlightened is just creating more karma. And you can't afford it. Try to get up to the door. But at that point, you have to surrender even trying. There's no stance you can hold on to. Questions about reincarnation and karma? Or about anything? Yes. The question is, isn't the decision to do the work as I see my manifestation, just do my karma, or do, we'll talk about later, my dharma, isn't that an act of free will? Well, that's on the plane. That's the plane where the seeing, thinking, desiring, choosing person is in fact experiencing free will. There is another plane from which all of that is lawful. And you can know that intellectually, but unless that's in your gut, you are still on the place where you must make choices. Yeah. Right behind you, yeah. Well, the predicament is that we can go through maybe 10 or 15 different systems like Meher Baba or Buddha's talking about reincarnation or Rodney Collin and so on and on and on. And you can say, well, it's in that time span or it is not. Like in the Hindu system, it'll say, you'll notice a number of times Krishna says to Arjuna, those who pray to the gods go to the gods. And you'll go to another loka, you'll go to, say, the heavenly plane, another plane of consciousness, where you will be for a certain period of time. And since time means something different there, you might be there for, say, from our point of view, 500 years. And then you would then once again take a human rebirth to get on with certain work, which can only be done on the human plane. Buddha, for example, says, the chances of your taking a human birth are 1 in 81,000 or something like that. And if you blow it this time, you may have to wait 81,000 more rounds as animals and creepy crawlies and in hell lokas and all that before you get around to it again. What I'm trying to say to you, I'm not going to argue Meher Baba versus Buddha and so on. I'm saying that whether or not you go backwards or only appear to go backwards or what experiences, like for some of us, this is a hell loka. For some of us, this is a heaven loka, even though we all think we're in the same room, right? These are mainly the predicament, just like the Ten Commandments, they are mainly the predicament of beings who are or have been one with it all, who come back into dualism and then use words to try to convey to other beings for certain purposes certain things. And you can't conclude anything but that these are various metaphorical systems to try to illuminate very dense minds surrounding these beings. Okay? Take what you need and go on, right? Take it all as teachings. Yes. The question was, would I say something about my experiences which validate reincarnation for me? I think when I said the three categories, maybe I didn't finish the thought, that, see, I'm faced with a peculiar situation because of my, quote, psychedelic history as being my entree into this domain at one level, and my whole life and many lives is my entree at another level, is that I was taking most of the psychedelics from, say, 61 to 66 with a Western psychological model going, although I was playing with the Tibetan Book of the Dead and a number of other metaphors. And there were many thousands of experiences that went through, that I had no conceptual model to be able to understand, so they merely went through unnoticed, or not unnoticed, but unlabeled or unintegrated. And then when I went off to India and started to study and connect with my guru and broaden out my understanding of another framework for understanding my own being, then slowly a lot of these earlier experiences started to click into place. And I'd be, oh, that's what that was about. Oh, far out. Oh, that's what I remember. Yeah, that, right. And I started to have these things, they were sort of lurking there, and suddenly they clicked into some meaning. Now, we're going to talk about death. In fact, we're going to do a death meditation here one night. But, for example, one day my guru is walking with a devotee, and he looks up and he says, oh, so-and-so Ma, this very loving older devotee woman, just died in this other city. He saw that with his inner eye, if you want to call it that. And at that point, he laughed and laughed and laughed. And the old devotee, who was very close to Maharaj, he said to him, why, you butcher. You know, if she just died, what are you laughing about? And he said, would you rather me make believe that I were one of the puppets? Would you like me to make believe that I think this death is such a big deal? Is that the way you'd like it? And living around Maharaji, who was constantly talking from a framework of reincarnation, and living in this village where all of the beings lived in that space, what happened was all those experiences in 67 to 70 started to resonate in a deeper and deeper place in me, and they felt right on and right on, and that's the way I live. I live totally intuitively. My reality is an intuitive reality. It is not a logically arrived at reality. And so that all I can say is at some point, reincarnation and the unfolding of karma over time ceased to be a theoretical possibility, a hypothetical construct, and became, yeah, right, that's the way it is. Knowing all that's just more mind stuff, by the way. I mean, we all will play many levels of game in our discussions here. So all I can share with you is that at some point it intuitively became, yeah, and I trust that space. Yes. Could a flower or a tree die and be through with all of this reincarnation? Be an interesting last round. I would suspect not. But I don't know. I am where I'm at, and I know I'm sharing the level at which I intuitively understand things. And when you ask me something, I, at that point, since I don't hear an answer, I go inside, I quiet, I empty, and nothing comes out of yes or no. Then I can grasp at my intellect and say, well, Mayor Baba said this, or Buddha said that, but I still don't know. So I can only answer, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting question about the significance of a human birth, about what ingredients are available to us specifically in terms of self-consciousness as a profound, necessary instrument for getting off the wheel. And that's just something we can reflect upon. It's not, there is an interesting point you're making, though, about looking at us as special. It is only at a certain way of seeing the dance that you look at one stage of evolution of consciousness as more desirable than another. Like, for a lot of us, we have to justify what we think we're doing now by saying it's better than what we were doing before. In fact, it would be enough to merely say it's different than what we were doing before. That if you look at the wheel as going on and on and on, and births following deaths, and people say you have the theory at this moment that you go back into the one and then go from the one into the many and the many into the one, pravritti nivritti, one into the many, many into the one into the many, and so you go through one back into the many, and then the many starts to awaken to its own oneness, and we're on that process back now to the one. You get back, you merge into the one, and then something new starts, and there's one into the many, and many into the one. And it's been going on and on, and since it's not in time, nothing's happening anyway. It only experiences that it's in time from one point of view, but the wheel is static. Change is static at another place. Change and solidity come together at that point. At that point, you look at another person, or another tree, or a rock, or that it's at a different place, and what do you say? I'm better than you. Better luck next time, buddy. I mean, it's not clear to me. I've gone through a series of stages about this where at first, like in dealing with my father, I used to feel sorry for my father. Now, it was very interesting. From where my father was sitting, he was feeling sorry for me, all right? And it was the same experience I had when I was in Banaras, the city of dying in India. When the first time I went there, I looked at the people on the streets that were leprous and that were ill and that were dragging themselves around, and I felt such incredible pity and horror at their suffering that I literally went and I hid in my hotel room. And the next time that I went back, by then I had been in India sometime, and I went back and I was able to set aside my own mind trip a little bit and just look at these other beings and look in their eyes. And I suddenly saw a look in their eyes which I'd never, ever expected. Because they were the ones that had lived their lives so purely that they were going to be allowed to die in Kashi, in the holy city where then Shiva whispers the name of Ram into your ear on the burning ghat as you're being burned and you're totally liberated. And they knew they'd made it. And they're looking at me and they're saying, this poor Western slob, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's just going from place to place. He'll never die in Kashi. You know, he'll never be lucky as I am, sitting here with my leprous sores, you know, and my just enough paisa to buy the wood for my funeral pyre. I've made it. And I saw this complete perceptual flip, and that helped me get to the point of starting to have compassion. In the broader sense of compassion, not pity, that means have a recognition of how it all is. How it all is. How it all is. And look and see another person as they are, without getting my mind going in, if they were only this way, it would be better. And realize that any form is in the realm of suffering. All form is in the pure Buddhist concept of suffering. Looking at it through Krishna's eyes rather than through Arjuna's eyes. Not better and worse, but just different. Yes. How is astrological influence related to reincarnation and karma? Later we're going to be talking about individual differences, and astrological differences are karmic manifestations. That is, you reincarnate into an entityness at every single plane, and these are all at lower levels of manifestation, the way in which the planets relate and which planetary configuration you will be born under, you will be conceived under, and you will have various experiences. That's all within the lawful realm of prakriti or nature. Yeah. Give it all to me. The question was, do I have any suggestions for how to begin to give it all away? That's what all of yoga is about, right? How does it speak? What? Well, I think that the predicament that's characterized, the question was, last time we talked about Arjuna facing the awakening and the struggle with his own desires and the awakening of the soul in relation to his own desires and that beginning of that struggle. How does karma and reincarnation deal with that? Is that your question? And there are a couple of lines. One is that it is his karma that he is, quote, graced enough to be in that predicament, that he's beginning to awaken to the struggle. It is further his karma that even though he's begun to awaken, his desires aren't going to go away very fast, or his attachment to his desires aren't going to go away at all, but his attachment isn't going to go away so fast. That's the predicament many of us find ourselves in. We're living caught in this ripping sensation inside that won't stop. That there's that part of us which already sees through the game, and there's that part of us which is really caught in it. And that is just it's a step on the path. It's a perfect, lawful stage in the awakening. And if it's like, if you do one of those movies showing flowers bloom very quickly, like often when I was sitting with my guru, he would look at me and I could see that he was looking at this flower blooming where I could only see the stage of the flower I was at that moment. And now that I've started to quiet down more and more through meditation and just through mantra and through getting a quieter stance, I look at another being quietly enough and I see not only what they're in, but you can see the extrapolation outward. You can start to see the unfolding. And all of that is within Arjuna's predicament. Imagine the grace that should have allowed him to be born to be able to hang out with God. Right? Yeah. In Be Here Now, at one point I described going to see Maharaji, and I brought him a bag of oranges. And I brought the oranges up and put them down, and he took the oranges, and he started to eat them ravenously. And he ate 8 of them before my very eyes. Principal of a school was feeding me oranges, and I was crying, and everybody was crying, and the whole scene was a total mishugging the thing. And it was, and I said at that point that a guru often did this to take on the karma of another being. This is a very, very far out space, because I struggled with this for a long time about the free will and the guru. Like, are we all in law, but the guru isn't? And we're going to have to deal with this issue in much greater depth, I think. But let me, because at one point I said to Maharaji, aren't karma and grace the same thing? Like, if you eat the oranges to take on my karma, aren't you doing that because in the grand law and design of things, it was my karma that I would come to a guy who would eat 8 oranges to take on my karma? I mean, or was it my karma to just schlock along, eating my own oranges, and then this being, out of incredible compassion, said, look at this poor jerk, he's never going to do anything, I'll eat his 8 oranges for him, see? I mean, that's the predicament we face, right? Now, when you're within the bhakti system and when the guru is your all, he ate the 8 oranges out of his infinite compassion.